gathered in remembrance of Imam Khomeini and his ideas.
The charisma of Imam Khomeini not only inspired Iranians but had strong impact on hearts and minds of people all across the globe. That's why gatherings like these are held across the country by his lovers to show respect for the late leader.
Both Sunni and Shia scholars have stressed the need for unity among Muslims, which is one of the key teachings of Imam Khomeini.
Imam Khomeini raised the voice and the slogan that no East and no West. That is the spiritual and that is the real slogan which inspired to the nations, to other nations, especially as a Pakistani nation, we are very much inspired from this slogan and this point.
Participants also chanted anti-US and anti-Israel slogans. People emphasized the real identity of the Muslim Ummah that has been distorted and tarnished by certain enemies of Islam. They believe in the Islamic identity that Imam Khomeini has introduced to the world.
We think the way and the thoughts of Imam Khomeini must be spread all around the world between Islamic people. In order to make the Islamic countries more stronger and to, inshallah, to beat the enemies of the Islamic people around the world.
Imam Khomeini is the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who led the 1979 revolution against the Shah. He is widely respected among Muslims for his teachings and views on freedom and unity. He is also admired for his efforts towards the Palestinian cause. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Following intense UN-supervised meetings between the warring sides in Yemen, the UN envoy for Yemen announced that the parties have agreed to renew the current truce in Yemen for two more months. The truce is extended under the same terms as the original agreement, which first came into effect on the 2nd of April.
When the United Nations agreed to our conditions, which included releasing the salaries of government employees, we saw that it was our duty to respond to the renewal of the truce, although we were aware that the enemy would not respect the truce as it did previously. But we adhere to peaceful solutions and we will make concessions in order to end the war.
Observers say renewing the truce is a win for the Yemenis, who stood alone during 7 years of war without any support from the international community or the United Nations.
The United Nations was absent throughout the years of war, and the armistice is not an achievement for the international body, but rather a success for Sana'a, which remained alone in facing war and siege without any support from the international community or any allies.
Grundberg said he will continue engaging with the parties to implement and consolidate all elements of the truce.
People, he hoped that renewing the UN brokered truce will build for a comprehensive political solution to end the war that devastated their lives and country. They say the international community should now step in properly to support the political process in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
France's government has warned, don't expect inflation to return to normal until the end of 2023. At nearly 6%, French inflation is the highest since 1985, and the government says the peak won't even be reached until this winter. It's a stunningly serious diagnosis. Inflation has seemingly been the number one voter complaint since the euro currency was introduced in 1999, and now it's worse than ever. Many are pointing the finger at the pan-European project, with Brussels demanding austerity and forcing Paris to ignore mass protests and public opinion.
This inflation is a symptom of the profound crisis caused by the policies of neoliberalism put in place since the 1980s. Above all, the policies seek merely to enrich stockholders and create constant dividends. This inflation is going to last, and the government is only making a wild guess that it will end by 2024.
Across the EU, only Malta has managed to keep inflation lower. France has been saved by its constantly derided socialist-inspired measures, such as caps on energy prices. However, many are demanding more price caps, re-indexed pensions, immediate bonuses, higher wages across the board, and especially for low-wage workers, in order to keep inflation from making the poverty rate skyrocket.
All the countries of the European Union are basically already in a recession. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by a forced era of austerity, which created a structural lack of demand and investment in Europe. Making massive public investments with efforts to an ecological transition would create both jobs and demand for goods and possibly avoid another Great Depression.
80% of France says they're watching their expenses more carefully, which seems likely to push France's consumer-driven economy officially into a recession next quarter. 70% are distrustful of their economic future, which is record pessimism so soon after a presidential election. After all the austerity, the French are being told to expect nearly 2 years of widespread economic hardship. That may not only affect this month's legislative elections, but it could lead to major social unrest yet again. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...150 foreign ambassadors and officials have visited Tehran to take part in the 33rd anniversary of the passing away of a man who changed the course of history in Iran, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. Here, people believe the scale of Imam Khomeini's impact transcends Iran's boundaries.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran has proved to the Nigerian populace that if you are determined to eliminate any unjust leader and you follow the course, you can reach a result. In some of the curriculum of the higher education in Nigeria, there are some space being open for Imam Khomeini to talk about the Imam Khomeini and the revolution of Islamic Republic in Nigeria curriculum of education.
Thanks to Imam Khomeini, we have witnessed a freedom-seeking movement forming in Muslim and even non-Muslim nations, which challenges imperialism and encourages dignity and independence from the global arrogance. This is the miracle of the Islamic Revolution.
Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic.
For us, Imam Khomeini is a role model of resilience in the face of injustice. Today, we have come to renew our allegiance with him and the lessons that he taught us about self-reliance and resistance against the bullies of the world.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
Imam Khomeini is remembered here as the pioneer of a new era in Iran's history, an era that put centuries of monarchy behind and upended the Shah's domestic and foreign policies, replacing them with a political system that tries to rule the country based on the motto of independence from the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the Spotlight.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has begun its regular Board of Governors meeting in Vienna. With Iran's nuclear issue and Tehran's cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog expected to take center stage. Although the agency has said that Iran's cooperation with the agency remains, well, a lot to be desired, to put it in other words, its tone critical, however, stopping short of an outright resolution against Iran, at least for the time being. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the double standards of the agency and whether the failing maximum pressure campaign adopted by the E3, along with the U.S. at its side, will lead to the derailment of the talks. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Seyed Mostafa Hoshchesh joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, academic and political analyst Tohid Asadi, who also joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gemma, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Seyed Mostafa Hoshchesh, if I may. And perhaps you can give us a lesson in English and define for us what this means, this particular verb that I'm about to tell you. Reading off what the news has said, major European countries and the U.S. are expected to seek to censor Iran. Now, I looked up censor in the dictionary. It says express severe disapproval of someone or something, especially in a formal statement. But maybe you can put that into perspective for us, what it means.
Okay. Hello, thanks for having me. Let me explain it this way. An IAEA Board of Governors resolution that they have warned to adopt could produce various results that vary from just censuring Iran and reprimanding to the worst case scenario, sending and referring Iran's case to the UN Security Council, voting on revival of sanctions, which would definitely receive the Chinese and the Russian vetoing and would lead to nowhere, producing no result for the Americans and Europeans. So it's a political show with no action and with no, you know, result in perspective. Because if they really meant action, they wouldn't need adopting a resolution at the IAEA. They could simply resort to a faster, easier way to go for the trigger mechanism, which would refer the case to a UN Security Council veto-proof voting on the revival of sanctions, which would put an end to the Vienna talks, put an end to the JCPOA, and that's it. So it's no strange that they have gone for a political circus show. Because after the Iranian initiative last month made Borrell and Mora, the European foreign policy chief, actually, and his deputy, happy for a few hours when he was returning from Iran to Europe, and he, until he received the similar no bullying response of the United States to push the talks into a deadlock, Washington has been using its worn-out instruments and scenarios that have been in use for the past four decades against Iran, including resorting to cyber attacks, resorting to media warfare, promoting the weak opposition as if they've never been supporting them and they've just started supporting them, just to magnify, you know, the impact of their propaganda, and using Israel for cyber terror and sabotage attacks, and the last one being the threat to adopt an IAEA resolution, all for one purpose: levy political pressure through these worn-out scenarios to make Iran retreat in the Vienna talks.
Okay.
Iranian response, definitely we'll talk about it later.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at what Rafael Grossi has said, the IAEA Director General, Toyed Esadi. He came out when the Board of Governors began, and basically repeating his anti-Iran rhetoric. He made some allegations that since February 23, 2021, the agency activities have been seriously affected by Iran's decision. But what's very interesting, if you go to the IAEA website, there's a page where it says joint statement by Mohammad Islami, the VP and president of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and Mr. Rafael Grossi, where it says the AEOI and the IAEA have agreed in the continuation of the cooperation, as stated in the joint statement of 26 August of 2020. So I said all that, meaning that both in the IAEA state website have acknowledged cooperation, yet Rafael Grossi comes on and says, we're not getting the cooperation that is required. Can you please explain to us the discrepancy here, as I stated?
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for having me. And secondly, as Said Mustafa was mentioning in a very correct way, there is a wide spectrum of evidence to put forth the claim that the performance, the decisions, and the courses of action that we have been observing from as far as IAEA is concerned, actually, all in all, if you just take a look at what they are doing, it is a clear indicative of the very fact that the behavior is quite unstable and under impact of a range of or a set of determinants that shouldn't be. So basically, when we're talking about IAEA, we are talking about a so-called technical body, international body, which should set its decisions on the basis of technical issues. But in practice, when it comes to the decisions that we see pertaining to Iran, most of the time, these decisions are made on the basis of political considerations, and these kinds of discrepancies, this kind of paradoxes that you see and you properly refer to, are coming basically from this basis. We know that there is a clear lack of partial performance when it comes to IAEA due to the influence of third parties, regimes like Israeli regime, the United States, and other actors and players which try to put their political will and impose their political will upon IAEA. So the result is that we see less technical, reports and more political reports from the side of this international body. The consequence, of course, as far as the Iranian side is concerned, is that such a performance could easily kill the trust of Iranians, and I think it has already done that. And if they decide to act on their right minds and just provide a better circumstances, not only for the ongoing talks in Vienna, which again, due to such decisions, faced a kind of, stopping due to such courses of action, but also if they really try to prove the world that they are such an independent organization, they have to reconsider their decisions. And it is not really limited to Iran. Just take a look at Israel and take a look at how IAEA faces this regime, regardless of all things that we know about the nuclear facilities of this brutal regime. So I think it goes without saying that the unstable behavior and this zigzagging policy formulation, zigzagging decisions that are coming from IAEA are all showing that it's not a an independent body which right. should trust it. And this double standards that said Mustafa properly mentioned is observable in a tangible way in the performance of this international body.
Before we continue with the rest of our discussion, I have to ask you, Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh, about the new sanctions that were announced by the U.S. Treasury Department, which is somewhat confusing because the press release says members of the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, TFTC, sanctioned 16 individuals, entities, and groups. And then it says all of these targets have been previously designated by the U.S., and they include three individuals associated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force. Can you explain these sanctions for us and why they're coming at this time when the Board of Governors meeting began?
Well, it's completely clear, as I explained in the first question, response to the first question. They're using every possible means. That's why, actually, I said these are worn-out scenarios and instruments, because they are now copy-pasting these sanctions. It started under Donald Trump in order to build up different layers, actually four layers of similar sanctions. Sometimes they vary in names and in wording, but the purpose is the same. Sometimes the sanction is altogether the same, just to leave psychological impact on Iran first. Second, to remove one of these layers under a possible deal and keep the similar sanctions actually with similar impacts and effects in place, so that Iran cannot benefit from any kind of deal and will be forced to go for JCPOAs over its other power components like the missile industry and regional power. But it's quite, you know, a notorious move. Just last week at a Senate hearing, Rand Paul also made similar, you know, statements similar to what you just said, that if you're dealing with Iran, you need to show goodwill. It's called, even from the American perspective, it's called carrot and stick. He was objecting, you know, he's a Republican, he's an American senator, and he's not on the side of Iran. He was saying, okay, you've always shown the stick side, like Donald Trump, you've never shown any kind of carrot. If you really are honest in talks with Iran, you need to remove part of the sanctions and ask Iran to join for further negotiations to discuss, you know, the deal. But you're just, he said, you have just declared, and he was speaking to Rob Mali, the UN envoy on Iran, that you have just declared new rounds of sanctions, similar sanctions that you just mentioned. They were first declared by Rob Mali in a Senate hearing last week, and Rand Paul was objecting to this kind of policy. They do not really mean, you know, to remove the sanctions. They have never meant that, because they do not mean to resolve the conflict with Iran. This has already been proved under six agreements with Iran in the past 22 years.
Okay.
The JCPOA was the sixth one. What they want is not a conflict resolution. They want to contain Iran. This is called the containment strategy. So they reinvigorate the sanctions, do the copy-pasting in order to keep them in place.
Right. Well, let's take a look at what the AEOI chief has said, Iran's AEOI chief here, Toid Asari, concerning two issues which Rafael Grossi has mentioned, which appears to be the two sticking points, if you want to call it that. Of course, there's always a sticking point, even if things get clarified. But one of them has to deal with the idea that Rafael Grossi says these nuclear particles were found in three alleged nuclear sites. You have the AEOI chief saying that Rafael Grossi does not have serious will to admit that Iran's answers are convincing. And he also, on that issue, said that the IAEA invokes intelligence reports provided to it by Iran's enemies with the Israeli regime at the top. He gave those two answers, but it seems like answers were given on these alleged nuclear particles that they're talking about. The other has to deal with the cameras, of which Islami said, we have already made it clear to the IAEA that access to this surveillance data and recordings depends on the fate of the agreement, the JCPOA. Sounds like he's given his answers. Why is the IAEA still pursuing the path on these two issues?
Well, let me just touch upon the idea of sanctions and U.S. sanctions for just a few sentences. I'm going to get back to that question immediately. Well, I think when we're talking about the United States foreign policy pertaining to Iran, we're talking about a wider grand strategy rather than small tactics. So when we're talking about sanctions, when we're talking about imposing some let's say statements on international bodies, these are all part of a bigger or let's say wider toolbox in the foreign policy behavior of the United States. And this is part of a maximum pressure that Trump started. And now after this isolationism of the United States, they are trying with Biden administration to expand the scope of it to other countries in order to share the burden of this maximum pressure and then have other players involved in it. So that's just one point that I wanted to add. But getting back to your question, I think we see a really paradoxical behavior from the side of IAEA. Of course, part of this paradox, as far as I know, comes from the very fact that most of the reports, most of the statements that we hear from these so-called international bodies and their, let's say, key people, does not really come from the truth and the realities on the ground, but they are coming from some baseless, accusations and baseless claims that Israeli regime provides them with. And this is part of the obnoxious foreign policy that Israelis and the Americans are following when it comes to Iran. And you see the realization of these, policies when it comes to IAEA reports or other similar statements. So if you're looking for the reasons behind it, you shouldn't really look for it in Iran, but you have to just take a look at the false, baseless, irrelevant, lines of argument that mm-hmm. has, irrelevantly met in the Israeli regime. But as far as the camera and in a broader context, as far as the Iran's permissions for IAEA to have access to its nuclear facilities are concerned, the truth, again, is that Iran has shown for the past years, and particularly after JCPOA was signed and sealed back in 2015, all these years and for the years even down the road, we can say that Iran has shown and will show a kind of extraordinary flexibility
sure.
to giving access to the cameras and other things.
So exactly.
Extraordinary monitoring here. But regardless of this huge amount of being cooperative, what we see in response, which is quite disappointing, is such negative statements that we hear and we see from the, key people in these
sure.
international organizations.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the cooperation is out there, and even the IAEA has acknowledged the cooperation that Iran has had, and Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, everybody knows, I'm hoping, that is, at this point, that the IAEA's inspection is one of the hardest and toughest and most extensive. So why do you have the IAEA Director General, of which it seems like they're cherry-picking his statements, say, since they, Iran, are continuing with the process to enrich uranium, well, then it's a matter of just a few weeks to get enough material to create a nuclear bomb, where in reality, an expert says weaponizing will still take 1 to 2 years.
More, even more, because weaponizing nuclear materials comes in three phases. First is producing uranium, enriching uranium above 93.4%. Second, means of delivery. And then the third phase is minimizing, the needed material into a small space and weaponizing it so that it detonates and creates the impact. So it needs three steps. It takes a long, long way for any country to do that. So the answer is pretty well clear. Iran has been under the harshest regime of inspections before the JCPOA and after the JCPOA, and they've never found a shred of evidence. But on the eve of the JCPOA endorsement, the ex-IAEA Director General, Yukio Amano, was asked if he would declare Iranian nuclear program to be completely peaceful based on the contents of the JCPOA, there are two ways that this dossier is ended. One, waiting for 10 years for a final decision of the major powers in Iran, or 2 years before that, on the eighth year, if the IAEA declares that Iran is pursuing a completely peaceful nuclear program, then everything is ended, everything will be normalized, and done is done. And the former IAEA director general said, even if it's proved to us, we will not declare that, because Iran's case is no way a legal, technical issue. It's a political issue. The superpowers should make the decision. That is very much telling. The IAEA is not an independent body. It's an instrument, like many other UN affiliated bodies. It's an instrument for the United States to expand its hegemonic rule and to maintain its hegemonic rule. Otherwise, why should the IAEA director general rely on one main source, that's Israel, that's a sworn enemy of Iran, sworn enemy of the JCPOA? It's not a member of the IAEA. It's not under international surveillance and monitoring and inspections.
Okay.
And while it is suspected of having 200 to 400 nuclear warheads, it's an aggressive regime. It's a killer regime. It's an occupying regime. It has been defying UN members' calls, UN Security Council decisions, and it's a very irresponsible and aggressive regime. Why should it be the source of the IAEA and the IAEA Director General
Very good question.
Travels to the Israel on the eve of the IAEA meeting on Iran?
Right.
It's sending this message that we are also an instrument of the United States. If you don't do what we want, what the U.S. wants, we increase the pressure. And Iranian response is very clear. Under President Raisi's administration, the policy is active resistance and also muscle flexing and show of power. The hit-and-run era is gone. If you do any hostile move to us, it will be reciprocated with responses twice tougher, twice more. That was shown in the case of the crude supply of Iran that was seized by the Greek when Iran seized two Greek ships. So I'm here to promise you, I know you're short of time, but let me give you this final sentence. Maybe we won't have time for the next question. If they ratify a resolution at the IAEA on Wednesday, they will receive a response twice more tougher, twice more and twice tougher, in a matter of 24 hours. The United States knows from the Greek seizure and Iranian seizure of Greek
what
ships.
What do you think that would be?
It was declared the policy of Iran, the resistance and the muscle flexing policy was displayed. It was declared by Iran in that story, which happened a few weeks ago, that the hit and run era is gone. Iran's responses would not be balanced. It would be twice more.
Okay.
And the Iranian responses will come in two, three eras. One, nuclear. Two, other power components, including missile industry or regional power. From these three areas, definitely Tehran would provide them with a response in a matter of 24 hours.
Very well. Unfortunately, we've got to end it there.
Americans have realized that Iranian threats are credible, and they would probably retreat into a statement rather than resolution against the Iran.
Very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Said Mostafa Khoshesh, journalist and political analyst. Toida Sadi, thank you, academic and political analyst, both from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takway, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The U.S. president's immigration policies forced refugees into detention, where they faced horrific abuse and mistreatment, a rights group says. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ryan Devereaux, author. This article is titled, Joe Biden Detained Tens of Thousands of Asylum Seekers in the Last Year. President Joe Biden's immigration policies on the U.S.-Mexico border have fueled the prolonged detention of tens of thousands of asylum seekers in the past year, according to a new report by a human rights group. Nearly all the immigrants apprehended by authorities during the period were taken into custody in a region where asylum access has been largely shuttered since March 2020, and where anyone who asks for asylum outside a port of entry, a right enshrined under domestic and international law, is considered a threat until proved otherwise. Drawing from nearly 300 individual accounts, the 66-page report published recently by Human Rights First describes activists, dissidents, student organizers, and others fleeing persecution in dozens of countries, only to languish for months in U.S. detention centers. The report documents dehumanizing conditions within those centers, heightened levels of racist and abusive treatment of Black asylum seekers, children held in adult facilities, massive legal and economic challenges for those in custody, and the ongoing separation of families across the U.S.-Mexico divide. Rebecca Gendelman, an associate attorney for Refugee Protection and Human Rights First and lead author of the report, told Intercept, "Detention is dehumanizing, dangerous, and cruel. It cuts off access to legal representation and information, preventing asylum seekers from fairly representing their claims for protection. It inflicts physical and psychological harm. It fuels family separation and re-traumatizes people, including those who were detained, tortured, beaten, and threatened by the governments of the countries they fled. And it coerces people into giving up on their claims." The report comes just a month before the Biden administration is expected to lift Title 42. A Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rule issued by the Trump administration in March 2020 over the objections of career public health professionals at the agency, Title 42 has been used to summarily expel or rebuff most migrants, including asylum seekers, and between official ports of entry.
With the lifting of the order, advocates and law enforcement officials anticipate a significant increase in individuals attempting to cross the border and apprehensions to rise as a result. Human Rights First report raises concerns that the Biden administration's current enforcement priorities could mean that more asylum seekers find themselves in U.S. detention centers in the month ahead. As the Biden administration ends the illegal Title 42 policy and restores compliance with refugee law, it should not jail asylum seekers who it processes into the United States. It should welcome them with dignity, Gendelman said, adding, the government should partner with NGOs to put in place a humanitarian reception system for asylum seekers coming to the border. The report scrutinizes the enforcement priorities that Biden first implemented as interim measures a month after taking office. In September, the priorities were made official in a memo that the head of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement issued, directing personnel to use discretion and focus enforcement resources in a more targeted way. Biden has vowed to break with his predecessor on immigration matters, pointing to former President Donald Trump's separation of families on the border as a criminal act that violates every notion of who we are as a nation, as he claimed. His shift in priorities did mark a change. Trump made nearly every undocumented immigrant in the country an equal priority for deportation, but it also contained an important caveat for the border itself. Any non-citizen who poses a threat to border security was still considered a priority for apprehension and removal. Under this framework, a threat to border security has meant anyone arrested attempting to enter the country illegally at a port of entry or anyone apprehended on U.S. soil without authorization to be in the country after November 1st, 2020. Though there could be mitigating or extending facts and circumstances, and officials are encouraged to evaluate the totality of the facts and circumstances and exercise their judgment accordingly, Biden's priorities do not include blanket exemptions for any group. According to Human Rights First, U.S. immigration officials have used the priority placed on border security to justify detaining asylum seekers as a matter of course. In December 2021, ICE officer confirmed to Human Rights First that ICE jails people who come to the border pursuant to the enforcement priorities guidance, the report said, adding that the priorities have also been used to deny asylum seekers release from detention. Exact figures on how many asylum seekers the Biden administration has jailed are difficult to ascertain, the report noted, because ICE has for several years failed to produce data in a timely or consistent manner, despite being required to do so by law. Customs and Border Protection runs its own detention centers near the border. People apprehended by CBP are generally paroled, expelled, or transferred to ICE's nationwide jail network for further adjudication of their immigration case. If they are seeking asylum, those individuals are entitled to what's known as a credible fear interview to make an initial assessment of their case. Human Rights First arrived at its conclusion of tens of thousands of asylum seekers detained under Biden, with most taken into custody on the border, by extrapolating from the available data related to those interviews. We know that over 66,000 asylum seekers have been referred for credible fear interviews since February 2021, Gendelman said. Typically, the vast majority of credible fear interviews occur in detention, and we also know that the vast majority of people who have been booked into ICE custody under Biden administration have been coming from CBP custody. On average, the asylum seekers Human Rights First spoke with experienced nearly 4 months of detention, though many were jailed for up to 10 months or more. They included a Nicaraguan asylum seeker detained for 3 months and denied parole as a border security enforcement priority, an asylum seeker living with HIV in prison for nearly 5 months, and an Angolan human rights defender detained for 8 months, even though his wife and children are living in the United States pursuing their asylum claims, the report said. Asylum seekers jailed by the Biden administration have often remained in custody even after establishing a credible fear of persecution in their interviews with U.S. immigration officials, according to Human Rights First. While the total number of asylum seekers detained after receiving positive fear determinations has declined significantly in recent months, government data reveals that asylum seekers in ICE detention who established a fear of persecution have been jailed for an average of 10.75 months as of late March 2022, the report said. Erroneous negative determinations and month-long delays in conducting fear interviews have prolonged detention for many others. The report documented extensive final hurdles for asylum seekers in custody, with the average immigration bond in fiscal year 2021 set at nearly $10,000 and some set as high as $100,000. The report noted that the fact of being jailed, coupled with the lack of guaranteed access to a lawyer, greatly diminishes an asylum seeker's ability to meaningfully access the legal system to present their case. Inside the detention centers themselves, Human Rights First found horrific abuse and mistreatment, including an asylum seeker thrown into solitary confinement without clothing after a suicide attempt and denied access to a shower, toilet paper, and a toothbrush for 21 days. A Mexican asylum seeker who was sexually assaulted after ICE jailed him in a unit that did not correspond to his identity and for his own safety was forced to request to be held in nearly 24-hour lockdown in solitary confinement, and a Brazilian asylum seeker who was verbally abused by a Trappist when he sought mental health care. According to the report, multiple minor children have been illegally held in adult detention facilities even though they presented documentation of their age. Asylum seekers from black-majority countries receive particularly bad treatment, spending 27% more time in jail and facing harsher release requirements than other people held in detention. In one instance, ICE officers explicitly stated that they had been instructed to release Cubans, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans to create additional detention bed space, while ICE was simultaneously detaining large numbers of Haitian asylum seekers and migrants at the same facility, the report said. Human Rights First documented several individual cases of anti-black abuse in immigration custody. According to the report, asylum seekers had their braids or locks forcibly cut off by detention staff, and racist comments were directed at black asylum seekers that included references to slavery and lynching. In place of border security threat priorities for asylum seekers, Human Rights First is pushing for alternative to detention programs that would link those individuals with legal counsel outside the jailhouse setting. Such programs have proved highly effective at ensuring that asylum seekers attend their court hearings. A 2021 study by the American Immigration Council found that 96% of non-detained immigrants represented by a lawyer attended all of their hearings from 2008 to 2018. The alternative to detention programs are also vastly less expensive than the current model. Jailing asylum seekers is not only cruel, but it's also unnecessary and wasteful, Gendelman said. The Biden administration should instead use humane, proven, community-based case support to welcome asylum seekers and allow them to pursue their cases while living in U.S. communities. It's a cruel choice to detain them and a costlier one as well.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.